race for the White House enters its final months. Will the candidate's decision on running mates pay off?
Because vice presidents operate in the shadow of the U.S. president, their role is often misunderstood and unappreciated. They are, however, the first in line of succession when a president can no longer serve.
And Israel, bracing for impact following Iran's threatened attack.
There's a great degree of unpredictability here and uncertainty, especially after the assassination of these two leaders, Hezbollah leader in Beirut and the Hamas leader in Tehran, which was quite provocative.
And a terror threat forces Taylor Swift's three scheduled concerts in Vienna to be canceled. Today's Thursday, August 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London. With just 3 months left to make their case, the two U.S. presidential campaigns crossed paths on Wednesday in Eau Claire, a small city in the political battleground state of Wisconsin, critical to win in the November election. Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance.
I think that what makes Donald Trump and I good candidates and a good team is that we're normal guys who want to make this country great again. And we want Americans to be able to live the American dream.
Vice President Kamala Harris declared herself and her new running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, joyful warriors against Donald Trump as they spent their first full day campaigning together across the Midwest.
Do we want to live in a country of freedom, of compassion, of rule of law? Or a country of chaos, fear, and hate.
But after all the intrigue and speculation over the choice of running mates, how much effect does it have on voters? VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias looks at the historical relevance of vice presidential candidates and what Tim Walz and J.D. Vance bring to their respective tickets.
With great confidence in her decision, Vice President Kamala Harris introduced Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate on Tuesday in Pennsylvania.
In his state, he has been a model chief executive, and with his experience, I'm telling you, Tim Walz will be ready on day one.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump also hails the political record of his running mate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. But the former president recently downplayed the importance of vice presidential picks.
And I think this is well documented. Historically, the vice president, in terms of the election, does not have any impact. Mm-hmm. I mean, virtually no impact. And it's all about the presidential pick.
Scholars explain that because vice presidents operate in the shadow of the U.S. president, their role is often misunderstood and unappreciated. They are, however, the first in line of succession when a president can no longer serve and key to advancing their party's political agenda. Vice presidential scholar Joe Goldstein via Skype.
Their role is really to act as a subordinate to help promote and pursue the president's policies and to expand the president's ability to function as a national and international leader.
To a certain extent, VP picks can boost presidential campaigns, Goldstein says.
Bill Clinton's pick of Al Gore in 1992 was a very good pick. The combination of these two young Southern centrist baby boomers really sent a message of generational change.
A bad pick is how the analyst described Republican Senator John McCain's decision to have Governor Sarah Palin as his running mate in 2008.
And she really became a figure who was parodied during the campaign and I think ended up hurting the McCain ticket. It wasn't the reason that Senator McCain lost.
This election cycle, Tim Walz's credentials and his focus on pro-family economics is what the Harris campaign is betting on. Elizabeth Clemens is a political sociologist at the University of Chicago. She spoke with VOA via Skype.
A version of being pro-family that is not about the control of reproduction, but is about the economic support of families, be that education, healthcare, housing, job development.
J.D. Vance will help advance the Republican narrative, says analyst Peter Loach. Loach is director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. He spoke via Zoom.
The narrative they're telling that is, you know, there used to be an America in which if you worked hard and played by the rules, middle class, hardworking family, you could succeed, and that America is now gone. And that if you vote for them, that America will come back.
Even if vice presidential candidates rarely make a major difference in elections, analysts say U.S. voters will pay attention to how well the current VP picks listen to the electorate and channel their concerns. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Russia said Wednesday it was fighting intense battles against Ukrainian forces that had penetrated its southern border near a major natural gas transmission hub. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma brings us details.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is describing a Ukrainian incursion into the country's southwestern Kursk region as a large-scale provocation, as his officials say they're fighting off cross-border raids for a second day. Ukrainian officials are remaining quiet about the scope of the operation. If confirmed, the cross-border foray would be among Ukraine's largest since Russia's full-scale invasion in February 2022, and unprecedented for its deployment of Ukrainian military units. Kyiv's aim could be to draw Russian reserves to the area and potentially weaken Moscow's offensive operations in several parts of Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region. But it could risk stretching outmanned Ukrainian troops further along the front line. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And asked about the situation, White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre Wednesday said the U.S. had no prior knowledge of the attacks, but she emphasized it supports Ukraine's efforts to defend themselves against Russian aggression.
They are going to take actions, right? Common sense actions to protect themselves from these attacks. But as for the specific operation, we're going to reach out to them to see what their objective is and continue to stay focused. We are going to continue to stay focused on making sure they have what they need to defend themselves against Russia's aggression.
Russia's health ministry said 31 civilians, including 6 children, had been wounded. Following last week's prisoner exchange between Russia and Western powers, several of the political prisoners released by Moscow have arrived in Germany, a place that has historically been a refuge for Russians fighting for change in their homeland. Marcus Harten narrates this report for Ricardo Marquina in Berlin.
The prisoners released from Russia in this month's historic exchange with the West arrived in Germany, a country accustomed to receiving those escaping Russian repression. Vitaly Vobar arrived in 2022. He used to be one of the few opposition members of the St. Petersburg Regional Parliament. After he spoke out against the invasion of Ukraine, the Russian secret services came knocking on his door. It was then he knew it was time to leave. He says there are still many people in Russia with democratic and anti-war values, including among elected officials in cities like Moscow, St. Petersburg, and others. But Vobar says that speaking out openly against the war is prohibited and poses a great risk. When the full-scale invasion began, thousands of Russians took to the streets, only to have their protests put down by police. One of the thousands who risked their freedom to oppose the war was Anja Demidova, a Moscow actress. By the time authorities ordered her arrest, she was already on her way to Germany. She sees little hope for change in Russia anytime soon. She says that among people who have stayed in Russia, there are many who hope that Putin is not immortal, that he will die at some point and things will change. But she adds, it seems that Russian attitudes of superiority have deep roots and are older and stronger than Putin himself. During the 2.5 years since Russia invaded Ukraine, Russian exiles have received mostly bad news. More arrests, more convictions, and the death in prison of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. There is a makeshift memorial to him in front of the Russian embassy in Berlin. bad news has become old news for a comedian known as Dan the Stranger, who fled Russia with his family the day the war began. He is less known in Germany, where he earns a modest living doing stand-up comedy. Despite the hardships here, he doesn't think he'll return to Russia. He says he prefers to earn less money, but feel free, and dedicate himself to humor as he wants, not as the authorities allow. That is why he does not live thinking about returning. He does not face it as something temporary. Since the time of the Tsars, and later the Soviets, Berlin has served as a place of refuge for those fleeing repression in Russia. Many exiles see the current tensions between Moscow and the West as a new Cold War, with Berlin once again assuming its role as a symbol of the divide between the Kremlin and the rest of the world. For Ricardo Marquina in Berlin, Marcus Harten, VOA News.
The Nobel Peace Laureate, tapped to lead an interim government in Bangladesh, called for calm before boarding a flight in Paris Wednesday to return home, a day before his new government is expected to be sworn in to replace ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina.
I'm looking forward to going back home and see what's happening there and how we can organize ourselves to get out of the trouble that we're in.
Mohamed Yunus was picked to lead the new interim government, a key demand of student demonstrators whose uprising drove Hasina to resign and flee to India on Monday. We are following these other stories from around the world. Far-right demonstrations that had been anticipated by police in dozens of locations across Britain failed to materialize Wednesday as peaceful anti-racism protesters instead showed up in force. Police had prepared for another night of violence at 100 locations following a week of rioting and disorder fueled by misinformation over a stabbing attack against young girls. A court in Thailand Wednesday ordered the dissolution of the Progressive Move Forward Party, which finished first in last year's general election. The court ruled the party violated the Constitution by proposing an amendment of a law against defaming the country's royal family. And the head of the World Health Organization said Wednesday he will convene an expert group to determine if the increasing spread of the Mpox virus in Africa warrants being declared a global emergency. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said that given the increasing spread of Mpox cases beyond Congo, he's decided to ask independent experts to advise as soon as possible. Britain and Egypt asked their airlines on Wednesday to avoid Iranian and Lebanese airspace amid growing fears of a possible broader conflict in the region. It comes as Israel is bracing for a looming attack after the killing of senior members of militant groups Hamas and Hezbollah. Joining us now is Brian Katulis, Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Middle East Institute. Brian, the U.S. has been calling for de-escalation of tensions on both sides. How much influence does the U.S. have in this situation?
The U.S. has a greater capacity than any other country from outside the region to shape the events. As we saw in mid-April, when Iran fired more than 350 ballistic missiles and drones at Israel, and then Israel retaliated. That was a rather constrained response. It didn't have much damage inside of Israel or Iran, and that was because the U.S. played a role. No other country, not China, not Russia, none of the European countries can play that role. So it's important to highlight that recent experience, but it's also important to remind ourselves that the United States is not the driver of these events. It's Israel, it's Iran, it's two terrorist groups, Hamas and Hezbollah. And because of that, and because those two terror groups are non-state actors effectively, there's a great degree of unpredictability here and uncertainty, especially after the assassination of these two leaders, the one Hezbollah leader in Beirut and Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas leader in Tehran, which was quite provocative. So I know the last couple of days, the United States has been working by, with, and through Arab partners, especially Jordan, Egypt, some of the Gulf states to send signals to Iran to basically have a much more measured response, if no response at all. But I'm not sure it'll work this time because of how provocative an assassination in the capital city, Tehran, of Iran was for the Iranian regime.
If there were to be a full-blown war, would the U.S. be somewhat obligated to defend Israel and, in effect, get itself into a war?
It really depends on what the next spark might be. There's no treaty obligation in the sense that we have with NATO allies in Europe. But the reality is that the United States, just in the last few days, faced attacks from Iranian-backed militias in Iraq. And we've seen that before. We've seen that also the Houthi attacks in Yemen against international shipping in the Red Sea. So what's often forgotten in the debate here, and with some who just simply point a finger at Israel and then simply say, well, if the U.S. just reads Israel the Riot Act and cuts off military cooperation and arms sales, this will somehow magically solve the situation. That's fantasy land, because it ignores the reality that Iran for decades has been investing in a network of terror groups that have actually undermined the stability of not just the countries of Lebanon, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, but broader regional and now increasingly global security. And the U.S. is not obligated to respond, but if the U.S. sees its own troops under fire from the same network of groups that are out there, it's sort of hard to disassociate ourselves from any actions that Israel takes. But again, in this instance, as President Biden has said, in the instance of especially the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas leader in Tehran, it was not helpful to what I think is still the primary objective of the Biden team, which is to get a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
And they've been saying, the Biden administration has been saying, ceasefire and hostage release talks are in the final stages. We've been hearing that for a while. It would seem counterintuitive for Israel to kill the Hamas leader who was actually representing the group in ceasefire hostage release negotiations. What's their incentive at this point? And do you really think that's accurate to say that we could be close to a deal anyway?
They have been saying, the Biden team has been saying that for many months now. And in essence, let's remember, you know, there's been one ceasefire in late November or early December for about a week between Israel and Hamas that led to not just the cessation of hostilities in Gaza, but it actually calmed the situation in the region. And that's a good thing. And it also importantly led to many hostages coming home, but not all of them. Now Hamas was the one that broke the ceasefire, that first ceasefire, because there was an attempt to extend it. Then there's been ongoing negotiations essentially since that moment, essentially for the last 8-9 months. It's gone up and down. There's actually been previous murders, assassinations, and strikes against Hamas officials involved in negotiations. Most prominently in January, there was a Hamas official in Beirut who was killed, who was a key interlocutor between Hamas and Qatar. Now, I see sort of these actions by the Israeli government to target Hamas's leadership as just the fulfillment of what they promised they would do. They essentially said, look, the leaders of this movement that killed more than 1,200 of our people and held many hostage, they're going to be targets in all of this. That's their definition of self-defense. That's how they think they're going to keep themselves safe. But it is at odds with trying to get to a negotiated settlement that releases the hostages. Now, Haniyeh, the man who was killed last week in Tehran, I would say he was a bit more peripheral to the decision making on the ceasefire talks. The key person is Yahya Sinwar, who's now been named the political and military leader of Hamas. He's the guy that's in the tunnels. And he was pivotal. If anything, Haniyeh was the political face and diplomatic face, important, but not pivotal to getting to yes on a decision. So long story short is I think the Biden team has pinned a lot of its policies on getting this elusive ceasefire in place. Problem with that is that the two central combatants to the war in Gaza, Israel and Hamas, are led by leaders that don't seem to look to diplomacy and a settlement to settle their interests. They still turn to force, and in the case of Hamas, holding on to hostages as their ultimate trump card to try to stay alive and survive as a movement.
Brian Katula, Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Middle East Institute. The World Meteorological Organization says record temperatures in July had detrimental effects on the well-being of hundreds of millions of people worldwide. WMO data showed widespread, intense, and extended heat waves have hit every continent in the past year, and global average temperatures have set new monthly records for 13 consecutive months from June 2023 to June 2024. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. A community of breastfeeding women in Uganda is helping mothers who are struggling not only to feed their newborn babies, but to keep them alive. Halima Athumani and Mukasa Francis bring us this report from Uganda's capital, Kampala.
In March, complications with Mbabazi Rusty's pregnancy led doctors to perform an emergency cesarean section and deliver her child at 36 weeks, about a month early. Rusty then suffered a cardiac arrest and was placed on life support. During recovery, she could not breastfeed her baby, and so the hospital was substituting formula.
He was given powdered milk, but unfortunately, he faced a condition called NAIC stage 1, whereby he wouldn't digest the powdered milk well.
Rusty reached out to the Ata breast milk community, and the baby started getting breast milk from a donor. Rachel Akujiziwe is the administrator at Ata breast milk community. She says the organization was started in 2021 by a mother whose recently born child passed away.
Because she had a supply, she asked the doctors, where do I put the milk? And they told her, all we can do for you is to give you tablets to dry it up. She said, but you see, I needed it. Meaning, there should be a mother or so, a baby who needs the breast milk.
The breast milk is from mothers who have babies between 0 to 6 months old. But it's not easy to become a donor. Akujiziwe says donating mothers can't be on drugs and must undergo blood tests.
The blood work that we do, we check for HIV, we check for hepatitis, we check for syphilis, we check for CMV. They are screened before they start donating, you know, this milk.
Sadia Hussein Mlangwa is a mother of two and found her body was producing more milk than her babies needed. That is how she learned about the breast milk community and says she is a committed donor.
The fulfillment that I will get from this, knowing that I'm saving a life somewhere or giving better health or just a better living to a helpless child, I'm like, what bigger sadaka is there than that, really?
The Ata breast milk community says they have helped over 500 babies over the past 3 years, providing 800 liters of milk from close to 150 donors. Halima Athmani, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
The Paris 2024 triathlons finally took place in the Seine on Wednesday after days of uncertainty and came as a relief for teams and athletes, as well as for Paris authorities, who promised residents a swimmable river as a long-term legacy of the Games. Sean Hogan with Reuters has the story.
Triathletes at the Paris Olympics on Wednesday were cheered on by a delighted crowd as the hosts gambled to hold the swim stage of the race in the Seine paid off. The Seine finally passed river water tests, ending days of uncertainty over whether the central Paris swim was viable after rainfall caused a rise in concentrations of infection-causing bacteria like E. coli. The decision to postpone the men's race at the last minute on Tuesday triggered anger among some athletes. Belgium's Martin van Riel wrote on World Triathlon's Instagram page, "If the priority was the health of the athletes, this event would have been moved to another location a long time ago." The races going ahead will come as a relief for Paris authorities, who have promised residents a swimmable Seine as a long-term legacy of the Games, with the triathlon a very public test. The gamble that the river would be clean enough was never guaranteed to pay off, as water quality varies widely day to day. Paris has spent $1.52 billion of public money on wastewater infrastructure to contain sewage and minimize spillage into the river. Mayor Anne Hidalgo took a dip earlier this month in a bid to convince doubters that the water will not make them ill.
Sean Hogan with Reuters reporting. And finally today, organizers of three Taylor Swift concerts in Vienna this week called them off Wednesday after officials announced arrests over an apparent plot to launch an attack on an event in the Vienna area, such as the concerts. Swift was scheduled to play at the Austrian capital's Ernst Happel Stadium on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday as part of her Eras tour. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.